Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We are presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, it's Matthew Penny in the building. We're going to talk about the Boston Celtics-Miami Heat series that is near and dear to his heart as a Boston sports fan. We're going to talk a little bit about the way that the playoffs can impact the 2022 NBA draft. Different trends, different things the teams are looking for in terms of team building, and whether or not you should consider that in your draft strategy as an NBA team. Finally, we're going to talk a little bit about some post-NBA draft combine narratives that seem to be forming. And then finally, mailbag. I've sent out the mailbag question siren already. I'm hoping that we get some good ones from the beautiful, lovely fans of the Game Theory Podcast. Thank you guys so much. Every time I send that out, I'm just so stunned with the amount of people that send questions. Like, it's crazy.
It's stunning so, after, because I drive home from here. It's about, I don't know, 5 minutes. And then I look at my phone. I'm like, 20 plus? What are these? And I just like, keep scrolling. And there's always some really good ones. There's always some pretty ridiculous ones. And then some we answer here. We can't get to all of them, but I like having the opportunity to have so much content to create too.
And we always really appreciate them. They're all, they all put a smile on my face in some way. So thank you all for asking. Penny, let's get started with your beautiful Boston Celtics. They're up 3-2.
Yeah.
They are one game away from the NBA Finals. Where are you at? Where's your headspace at here? What's going on?
I'm in a good place. There was a lot of yelling at the TV early when they started off slow, and it was a wrestling match. It was not very aesthetically pleasing, I think we would say. If you saw my group messages here, everyone said it was like the worst game of basketball they ever won. But you want to win the worst games of basketball you ever see. So to get a victory and get 3-2 heading back to Boston, I took a step back post game and I thought about this, and I've been workshopping a little bit. The Celtics have to win right now. And you think of the path they took to get here. You take advantage of sort of a disjointed Brooklyn Nets team to start. You get to Milwaukee with an injured Chris Middleton. Jimmy Butler, Tyler Hero, Kyle Lowry all banged up from Miami. Duncan Robinson's in this like weird place that's not a fully healthy Victor Oladipo, which is kind of like a constant, unfortunately, the last few years. You look out west, I don't like how they match up with the Suns, despite they split the two games a season. And then you have like the fadeaway, Luka Nia put the Suns down in seven games. So like they're out of the way. Al Horford is 35 years old and playing out of his mind. Who knows if you get this Al Horford a year from now, no matter how much you invest in your body, Father Time is still undefeated and he's on like this different plane right now. And it's hard to win when other teams are down or have these disadvantages you have to capitalize. And luckily for the Celtics, despite the slow start last night, they're in a great place. They're up 3-2 and a game away from the NBA Finals.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the injuries. Not to take anything away from Boston, because I don't think you should. Like, injuries happen in the playoffs. This is what it is. Like, there's not really an NBA champion, I would imagine, that had a clean runway to get to the finals without other teams being hurt. And I can see that narrative forming a little bit already on the internet, and it's a little bit annoying to me. Like, you play who is in front of you, and Boston has done an incredible job of just beating the teams in front of them thus far, and they've done it by being kind of deeper than everyone else, right? Like they just have different ways to beat you across the board. And, you know, I kind of want to talk about a couple of just little small things that Ime Udoka seems to be doing, but like it's a testament to the Celtics that they are a little bit deeper and that they are a team that can deal with injuries to Robert Williams and can deal with Marcus Smart being out. Like the Celtics haven't dealt with a clean bill of health themselves. And I think that it's a bit dismissive of them to just act like the only reason that they're here is, oh, Chris Middleton's out. Oh, Tyler Hero, you know, missed game five. Oh, you know, they got lucky with the Brooklyn Nets being a total terrible disjointed mess in the first round. Like it takes away how strong this roster has been built by those in charge and the particular strategy that they've undertaken building this roster in terms of just adding depth and adding different kind of ways to counter the mismatches that other teams try to create.
And the injury, because I can hear the Sullys and Fitzies yelling at me. Marcus Smart has been hurt. Like Jalen is not 100%. Tatum's got like his arm socket thing. Robert Williams, God bless him. Like he's playing as hard as he can. Not this game, but the game before. So that'd be what? Game four, five?
It would have been game four, yeah.
He was like hurt. Did you see that? He was hurt and like hobbling up and down the court. I'm like, please call timeout. Throw the ball off somebody's leg. Just like get him out of the game. And they kept him like missing and he's running back and like he won't stop because it's kind of how he is. And the Celtics have also had the benefit of an 80% Robert Williams as rim protector is still like an advantageous center in the playoffs because they're just playing him in spurts too. So yeah, the Celtics aren't 100% either, but you have to take advantage of the disadvantages and build from there. It was watching last night and watching throughout the series and just talking about Miami to start here with Jaylen Brown. He's had a lot of moments where the handle and dribbling has gotten like really shaky, which seems unlike him. Like every time he puts the ball on the floor and gets in the lane, I kind of like hold my breath now. And Ime Udoka got at him a little bit. So like, all right, I read the quotes after the game after three quarters, said, okay, it's been three quarters. Like we got to win now. Like take care of the ball. He simplified his game. He hit catch and shoot threes, kind of put Bam out of bio, sort of on a poster, but it was a business decision. Like, yeah, go ahead. Like, you got that. I'm not going to be here in the highlights. And the wildest thing about it, and this is about roster building, and I have to credit my friend Zach for calling this out. Even with Jaylen Brown, at times, deficiencies on offense, right now he would be, what, Miami's second-best offensive creator with Jimmy Butler hurt, with Kyle Lowry, not the same player right now. Gabe Vincent's probably like not that guy. So you think of the depth of what the Celtics have. And even when Jaylen Brown's not at his best, he's probably Miami's like number two right now. And I know Joel Embiid's had a field day with the tweets and saying like Miami needs another star. But it's more sort of credit to the Celtics and the way they've built their roster that it's sort of next man up. And you can have a guy not be 100% all the time offensively on the floor and still succeed and win in the playoffs.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. Like this Miami team, what they're struggling with is just half court offensive creation, and Tyler Hero missing game five just like put it firmly on display for everyone. It felt like there's just not another way to say it. And you know, defensively, Boston is just using this too big lineup, especially with Hero out. Like there's just no recourse, basically. Like they can play multiple guys that just have size and can take up all of the space in the world, but also move their feet because Al Horford can move his feet and Robert Williams can move his feet a little bit, like quite a bit, to be honest. So every time that those guys are out on an island, it's a small advantage for Miami, but it's not a significant advantage. And it stinks for Miami that they're not totally healthy, but I think that Boston has done a good job of figuring out how to utilize its personnel within these games to just make it exceptionally difficult for Miami to really do anything.
And Boston's bench has shortened. They basically played seven guys last night. Then the end of the bench played like a minute each, but still found a way to kind of give you those different looks too throughout and give Miami credit for their fight. A lot of my yelling at the TV last night was the offensive rebounds. I mean, Miami had 9 in the first half, 19 total for the game. They had all these like second chance points where it's like just squeeze the ball and get out. And eventually Marcus Smart would get in there and mix it up. But it just wasn't, it didn't feel like it was that Miami team after the third quarter. I mean, the Celtics started slow and then they came out in the second half. They had some cleaner looks. They drove and kicked for corner threes. Tatum starts cooking. They win that quarter 32-16 and really held on from there. And it was almost like playing not to lose instead of win. And they kept chopping it away, but it was enough of a lead there where I didn't lose any sleep over it.
Well, and I love what, you know, Miami did defensively as well. Like, look, this was a game that was like purely in the mud. Like, there's another way to put it. Like, it was
you
a total
wearing
mess.
Good shoes. It was like the work shoes. You know, you got to get outside and get them a little dirty.
Yeah, it was just like a pure, absolute shit show mess of a game. But I liked what Boston did just to try and like do little things to get their guys free. Like using Derek White as a screener at times was really interesting, right? Like putting Miami's guys in space that might not be comfortable in space and might not be comfortable, you know, playing drop against Derek White or something like that. Or like even just switching the screen against Derek White or blitzing the ball against, you know, a Derek White screener. Action essentially is going to be exceptionally difficult because Derek can make decisions and he can make floaters and everything like that. I thought they did a really good job of getting Duncan Robinson into space and just forcing that mismatch whenever Duncan was on the court. It just does feel like something is off with Duncan, like be it confidence or something, right? Like he just doesn't feel as threatening. Like it didn't even feel like Boston was guarding him all that tightly as a shooter. Did it feel that way to you?
No, and this is also a byproduct of Kyle Lowry and Max Strus not being great. I mean, Strus missed 15 straight field goals. They were combined 0-15 last night, Lowry and him. They're 1-for-28 combined from the field the last two games. That actually helped Duncan Robinson get back on the court. And what took Duncan off the court, kind of ironically, was the defense at the end of the year into the postseason, not the offense. And Strus was like a little bit better at both of the time. And I don't really know like the story behind there. Like I don't know if he just hit a wall himself, if he's still injured. And Duncan's actually shot it better than you would think the last few games. He's 7-for-18 from three. But the threes are when the games are kind of like put away too. So anyway you slice it, he's kind of became replaceable, and that's how Strus took advantage of that.
And then the last thing here before we move on to like what we actually want to talk about in terms of like the playoffs and the draft. I mean, we talked about Al Horford quickly at the top, but like he has been, has he been the most important player in this series? Like Jason Tatum, you know, takes up so much defensive attention all the time that it's probably still Jason Tatum. But like Al Horford in this playoffs has been the, you know, the swing piece, let's say, maybe not the most important player, but like he has been the guy that has kind of changed the fortunes for Boston. You know, he's been able to step up for Robert Williams while he's been out and not just, you know, provide what Robert Williams can provide or provide solid minutes. He's been better than Robert Williams was throughout the year. And Robert Williams was freaking great throughout the year and deservedly, I believe, won second team all defense honors when those were announced last week. So it's, the Al Horford renaissance is something that, like, I thought Al was good. Like, if you watched him in Oklahoma City before they shut him down, like, he was pretty good, actually. Like, it was just clear that the Philadelphia fit did not work.
Right.
And he had no idea what his responsibilities were, and it just didn't feel like – Al was doing the things that make Al so successful in terms of being able to take advantage of his quickness, his positioning defensively, just everything that he's so great at. You watched him in Oklahoma City last year. Like he unlocked a lot for Oklahoma City, I thought, or I can't even remember if it was last year or 2 years ago. My brain is like so broken right now. I believe it was last year, but Horford, that get for the Celtics has just been so massive because I know that the regular season was just like, oh yeah, Al's back. Like he's back to normal. Like it's the Philly thing was just an aberration, but in the playoffs, he's emerged back into essentially like Atlanta Hawks, Al Horford, where he's all-star / borderline all-star center. And what an enormous acquisition essentially for Boston to be able to bring that Al Horford out of, you know, wherever he was sitting for the last 2 years, really 3 years, I guess. But more than that, the flashes were there. It just wasn't it wasn't this version of Al Horford, and it's unbelievable. It's so great that he's getting this moment too.
I hope the moment keeps going on. And there are a lot of grumbles and groans like, oh, we're trading or getting Horford back. Like, this is the guy who signed too much for Philly. That's why we let him walk. And now we're giving up a pick and Kemba, oh, whatever.
Do you remember the crazy takes? Moses Brown.
There's a lot of crazy takes around here. So you have to specify.
Moses Brown is going to be the most valuable guy acquired in that trade.
Yeah.
For the Celtics. That was a real tongue-in-cheek
or reality. If Jason Tatum is probably this is a hedge. If he's the most outstanding player, Al Horford is the most valuable because he's also taken a different roles. Like one of the games of the series, he had 5 points, but 14 rebounds, and he had 20 points the other game, and just timely plays and passes too. Every time you need a big shot, he's in the corner. He knocks it down. You can short roll and he makes the extra pass. It's a big rebound. It's a big defensive stop. I didn't think at his age he'd be able to defend and switch the way that he is.
Yeah.
And when you do that in the front court and then you're shooting, I think, 48% from three in the playoffs, that's the guy you want playing center. So it's disappointing that we don't have 100% of Robert Williams, but this different wrinkles to the Celtics going more to this, and he's playing 33-plus minutes every single night because you have to. You have seven guys and still doing more each and every game at 35 years old. It's incredible. So that's why I want the Celtics to win. Let's build the Al Horford statue, but we got to win a couple more games before we get there.
Yeah, to me, this is not like a dead series. Like, I think that Miami absolutely still has a chance. I don't ever rule out the Heat because this Heat organization is just so crazy when it comes to competitiveness. But it feels like Miami just doesn't have as many clubs in the bag and like doesn't have as many chess moves to be able to make to counter what Boston is doing. So it's going to take like Duncan Robinson, Max Strus, you know, maybe even like Gabe Vincent, you know, Kyle Lowry, these guys making large percentages of threes to really counteract and get the space that Miami needs offensively to operate for Jimmy and Bam in the middle. And we want to talk a little bit about Bam and this idea of the NBA draft, you know, portion of what we want to talk about and how to, you know, how to build a playoff team and, you know, how to build through the draft and, you know, what can we take away from the playoffs, basically. But Bam's lack of offensive growth the last couple of years, Bam is like literally, I think, one of the top three defenders in the NBA. He's unbelievable. He's incredible on that end and worthy of, you know, a top three, top five pick, I think, in the NBA draft. But he needs to get a little bit better offensively. Like, he needs to add a, you know, jumper in some manner. Otherwise, it is going to be harder for Miami to keep him out there consistently, but just to like take advantage of what other teams present him consistently.
Bam Adebayo was the guy that I still had nightmares over with the bubble, with him just really ripping apart the Celtics. And I know it's like the bubble is weird, especially for Miami, because it's already this unofficial asterisk because it wasn't like a real, it's a championship, but not looked at as the same. Tyler Hero put it out of his mind. Some people call him Bubble Boy. He leaned into it. He did the Bubble Boy t-shirt when he won Sixth Man of the Year, which is great. But yeah, Bam was such a monster there that teams started searching for the next Bam. Like, that's the guy. Like, is Onyeka Okongwu the next Bam Adebayo? Now we're kind of doing the, is Jalen Duren kind of have some shades of Bam Adebayo? It was just very different because despite, if you just look at the box score, he had 18 and 10 last night, but didn't feel like the same guy. I know he cooked the Celtics for 31 points in game three. Otherwise, he hasn't been the player so coveted that we immediately look for like the next one of who he is. And the offense, I think it'll still get there. Like, I'm not writing it off either. Does this look different if he has 18 and 10 and Jimmy Butler is 100% like he was the series before and he's scoring 30 points and yelling after each victory? That's possible too.
I think we're all still looking for the next Bam, and I think that is the right thing to be looking for.
Sure, but are we going to find it? Like, every class, is it going to be – right. Is it going to be the Bam? Is it going to be to find the lengthy wing that can do it all? No, that can be what you aspire to, but you're not going to, like, correctly put it in the box every single draft cycle either.
Yeah. I think the Celtics win at some point in the next two games. I don't know if it'll be game six or game seven, but I think the Celtics are going to go to the finals. I also said on our Tab NBA tip-off show that I thought the Mavericks were going to beat the Warriors in this series. So I hope that I didn't just jinx you, Penny.
So far, so good. Boston's a tough place to play on the road. It is. So game six, everyone's going to be all lubed up and excited. So Miami is going to need like an unbelievable showing from their wings and the Super Bam version to keep it close.
Yeah, and you're gonna head in and see all the Sullies and Fitzies.
TBD. We'll see. I kind of wait for my phone that text in the morning, and if I get the bat signal, I'll be there.
Oh my god! Every time I say the word Sully, I just think of it was a forced water landing, like from the movie.
Not that Sully. Yeah, that's a different Sully. Yeah,
not
we won't
that
be
Sully.
Forcing water. They're doing different water landings in Boston. They'll be ready to go there. Long weekend too? Are you kidding me? Take it off early. Go ahead into town. It will not be quiet. That's one thing I do promise. Can't promise wins and losses, but it won't be.
Okay. So the next thing we wanted to discuss is just this idea of whether or not you should take away lessons from the playoffs and implement them into draft strategy. And I think it's an interesting debate for a number of reasons in terms of just how much to do so. I'll just kind of ask you, like, is this something you consider when you're doing draft evaluation, when you're watching the playoffs, when you're, you know, keeping up with the NBA? How much are you trying to understand, hey, these are the guys that are valuable in the NBA playoffs. These are the guys we should be looking for as draft prospects?
Some. I don't want to get crazy and do like way overreacting. And then a few years later, we step back and say, why do we go so crazy on like this pathway? The biggest takeaway of seeing the last few years, seeing the draft, doing more draft cycle stuff with you is you have to keep a steady hand and you don't have to blow it all up. As some callers in Boston talk radio suggested we did in the middle of the year. You don't have to necessarily overpay for role player type guys. Like, I'm glad Duncan Robinson got $90 million. It was warranted for what he did as a shooter, but then he became expendable when he stopped playing defense and was hunted on defense more so. And it's a smaller sense with Peyton Pritchard. The offense isn't always good enough to negate the defense. He's not a bad defender, but unless he has 12, 14 points, it's kind of offsets everything else. And the Duncan Robinson thing, it only got more burned because, like we said, Max Strus like wasn't good enough for him to get out there. Wings still rule. Wings dominate. Two-way wings that actually defend rule more. We keep getting smaller by the game and by the series. Boston's rolling out these lineups with at least four guys that can comfortably switch, and that includes Al Horford. And when they don't, you have Robert Williams protecting the rim in the middle. So I look out west, and Golden State's waiting for Boston, Miami. They roll out their sort of new lineup of death with Draymond Green or Kevon Looney at the five at 6'6 and 6'9. So the Celtics, if they get there, in a perfect world, Robert Williams, who they drafted 27th, right, not 5th, and right. Al Horford, who's 6'9" and shooting out of his mind, the evolution.
And by the way, they're paying Robert Williams what, like $13 million
great
over the
deal.
Next yeah. 4 years, right? Which, like it's they're not investing significant resources in the center position as well.
So to get drafty, the evolution of the front court has continued. If you're over 6'9", you have to possess a real skill of shooting, shot blocking, switching, or a blend of all that stuff, or you're not able to play. That's why I'm really high on Jeremy Sochan. That's why I'm probably getting higher on EJ Liddell as first-round guys. They fit into that new front-court box. And I'll even like slide Keegan Murray into that because I do think he's long enough, switchable enough, shoots it enough, where I don't think those guys are being run off NBA playoff floors.
I did the Jeremy Sochan draft profile for the draft guide earlier this week. I think people are going to be very stunned with where I have him on my board.
Oh, boy. How high is too high? Do you have a new number one is the question.
Number four is too high. Hey, I don't know that I don't know that any other position beyond number four is too high.
Wow. So even with the offensive kind of, I don't want to say lapses, but the jumper doesn't really go in. Not a great free throw shooter. Can create, but can get there and actually finish. As good as the defense is, the switchability, does the offense scare you enough to, I guess not, if he's fifth?
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, you're dealing with a lot of imperfect prospects in that range. You can point to Shaedon Sharpe. We have no idea what he looks like on an NBA court. You can point to Ben Mathurin, who was not very good defensively throughout the course of this year. You can point to Dyson Daniels, who's a 29% three-point shooter. You can point to, Mark Williams, who, doesn't do anything on offense outside of dunk, right? Like, yeah. It is a lot, right? Like, there are a lot of flaws in that mid-lottery range, and that's okay. Sohan, I think, is probably going to be the guy that I bet on because of all of the defensive tools that we kind of have talked about. I think that his defensive tape is just freaking unbelievable. All defense caliber defender, essentially. And I hope that he can shoot. Made, I think, 34% of his catch and shoot shots this year in the half court. I don't think anything's broken mechanically, but he has some misses where you're just like, oh, this is bad. He does have, like, he brings it a little bit across his body, and, you know, he has like a slight twitch at the top or hitch at the top, but like, it's, yeah, there's enough there where you can make it viable, I think, with the right coach, and with the right coaching staff. But yeah, I'm going to be really high on him. I think he's freaking awesome, but that's my guy. That's like a modern NBA player that I think can grab and go on the break, can defend literally 1 through 5. Like, he is a genuine 1 through 5 defender on all but the biggest, like, Joel Embiid level fives in today's NBA. Like, he'll get hit on the glass against like Steven Adams, but I think he'll cook Steven Adams in space offensively.
Yeah. There's only so many Joel Embiids too. Like, how many games, how many times are you going to do that? And if you're exploding down the other end too, it bounces out.
Yeah. And we're talking about this with DeAndre Ayton right now, right? And like, what Phoenix should do with DeAndre Ayton. I think part of the reason that you should continue down this road, if you're Phoenix, is you probably need someone like DeAndre Ayton who can stay on the court in the playoffs, who, you know, can actually defend reasonably well in space, who's good in pick and roll coverages, who isn't awesome as a like rotational rim protector still. Like, he misses some rotations. I thought that series against Dallas, where Dallas really spaced him out, kind of laid bare a few of the places where DeAndre really has to work to improve. But like, I think that if you're Phoenix and you're trying to compete for a title right now, you actually do have to really consider the idea of, hey, this is who we're going up against. Like, if we're going to win an NBA championship, the odds are we're probably going to have to beat a Giannis. We're probably going to have to beat a Joel Embiid. We're probably going to have to beat a Nikola Jokic, who, by the way, DeAndre Ayton outplayed in a playoff series last year. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to have to face up with some of these bigger bodies. If you're a team that is still hunting for a superstar, I probably would not max DeAndre Ayton. If you're a team that has a superstar and has the rest of all of that set, or you're closer to competing for a title, like Dallas is to an extent, like, that's where I would consider DeAndre Ayton. But it's complicated because now you're going to have to pay DeAndre $30 million to go play for you. And that's a significant investment. And I don't know. Like, it's hard. It's a hard decision. Like,
do you max him then if you're Phoenix?
I max him if I'm Phoenix, and then if it turns to shit early in the year, I trade him.
Okay, so the max, but like the years too. So then you're kind of like beholden to figuring that out, the trade space afterwards as well.
Yeah,
it's not like the 1 year max and then hope year 2 and 3 you extend or whatever. You're saying like an actual max years, max money, or maxed in on DeAndre Ayton.
I would try to work out a deal where it's a 4 year max for DeAndre, where I'm signing him as Phoenix as opposed to having him go out and get an offer sheet. Mm-hmm. I would want to do a 4 year max for DeAndre where the advantage for him to take a 4-year max from Phoenix as opposed to signing an offer sheet from someone else is like you get 8% raises versus 5% raises, right? I don't know if he gets the 8% raises if he signs an offer sheet and then Phoenix matches or not. I believe he does not, if memory serves, but I'm not 100% sure. But like work something out there where it's a 4-year deal. He can't sign anything more than a 4-year deal elsewhere, but he can sign for more money on a 4-year deal with Phoenix. Do that. I think that that contract is pretty easily tradable next year or the year after if Chris Paul, you know, eventually ages and becomes not an all NBA point guard. Yeah. But I wouldn't blow it up if I was Phoenix. I would keep everyone intact and go for it. I don't know if that's what they're going to do, to be honest. But I said on the podcast with Kellen Olson, we did, a week and a half ago when they lost, that I would keep this intact and go. I wouldn't overreact to what happened against Dallas.
In 7 games, too. It's not like they were swept and you need to make a rash move like Charlotte loses. Like, hey, we got to remember head coach, we lost. It's like it's a playing game. Like, they're doing good. They're building. I'll tell you what, though. I'd rather have Robert Williams for 13 than DeAndre for 30.
No question, but I think that this is one of those weird, like, it's just such a strange team-building thing in today's NBA where because of the structure of the collective bargaining agreement and the salary cap, you kind of just have to pay it at the end of the day, I think. Because, like, what is their option? Like, a sign and trade with someone? I haven't heard a – I haven't seen a deal yet that I think makes sense for anyone. And I've tried to put them together. Like, I've been trying to figure out –
You fired up
like,
the trade machine. Well, it's difficult, too, because the teams that aren't the best, that are at the top of the lottery – well, for whatever reason, this year we got 3 to 5 like bigs that could kind of fit that mold, right? Detroit, you're out of the top three if you go big and try to sign there. But Orlando has a top pick. Houston has a top pick. Oklahoma City, like they have a top pick. I don't know if those teams want to invest that when they can build on the pieces that they already have and don't make DeAndre Ayton. So I don't like using this, but heliocentric for like their team. Like you don't have to play through. You'd have to, if you pay him as one of those teams, I feel like you have to play through him a little bit, whereas the others you don't, but then you have to be comfortable paying max money for not necessarily a max offensive player and scheme what you want to do.
And I'm not a fan of playing through DeAndre at this point.
No,
I mean,
I
think there's a chance he could develop that way, but like I don't think we've seen it from DeAndre.
No.
Where he's worth playing through. I think he can be like a 20-10 guy that is a borderline all defense player. But I don't think that really involves playing through him. I think it involves using him in ball screens and DeAndre being a little bit more aggressive, taking advantage of his size and like just fucking dunking on people. Right.
Yeah.
He's good enough and athletic enough and long enough and strong enough to be able to do that. So it's a weird one, I think.
Yeah, it's added too. I mean, the 3-point percentage is better. I think he's added kind of new layers to his game too. That's never obviously going to be like the complete game of it. But if you keep defenses honest, he's still the rim running big, finish more in the post, close out, rotate, be a weak side shot blocker. Yeah, but it's a big bill.
But like, is
30 million plus.
So to connect this back to our conversation, like, is he the line for what? For what a keeping a big on the court in the NBA playoffs is. Because I think you can absolutely keep DeAndre on the court because he's switchable defensively. He can punish switches, or at least theoretically can punish switches. He didn't really do it enough against Dallas, unfortunately. Is that the line? Like, and then like the other side of that line is like Rudy Gobert, where offensively he just can't put the ball on the deck at all and like can't punish switches at all and isn't strong enough to like really like post and seal against opposing. Like, is that is DeAndre the line kind of? Because like Bam, you can keep on Robert Williams.
The new Mendoza line is the 8 line for the NBA up front.
And like Robert Williams is like this too, like as well. Like, I think Robert Williams you can keep on the court. I think that finding the bigs that you can keep on the court that can also protect the rim and can also take advantage offensively in some way of the way teams play you versus be it skill, be it just punishing teams like Joel Embiid can offensively, you know, be it Nikola Jokic, who's like the most talented, like gifted offensive mind in the NBA right now. Like you have to be able to take advantage of the distinct like offensive value that you can provide in some way. DeAndre didn't do that against Dallas. DeAndre has done it in the past. I thought he did it in the first round, to be honest, against New Orleans. Rudy Gobert has not shown that proclivity yet, despite the fact that Rudy is the best defensive regular season player in the NBA and probably is deserving of a max contract on some level. Like it's what is that line? Trying to find that line is what's hard, I think, about like drafting bigs in general.
It is. And where does that guy fall? Like you mentioned Mark Williams. Is that worth a top 10 pick? I don't want to say I'm warming up on him. We've been pretty high on him all year, had him more in the 20s, now more in the teens. But is that, are you comfortable with that guy closing games beyond the court? Probably, right? But you're not saying, hey, let's take Mark Williams seventh or eighth.
It's interesting. Like, so I really like Mark.
I do too. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I'm going to have a lottery grade on Mark because I think Mark shows a lot of similarities to me to like a Jarrett Allen type where he's good enough at moving his feet in space to where he can play different ball screen coverages. He did that at Duke. He covered up for every single little fuck up that Duke's perimeter defenders, Duke's forwards particularly presented him. He was outstanding defensively across the board, I thought. Better at moving his feet and better positionally than what I think he gets credit for. But I worry about how limited his offensive game is. And I worry about how much he can actually punish opposing teams offensively because he is more Rudy Gobert-ish in terms of creating shots than, you know, DeAndre Ayton, where he can just like physically seal and, you know, get a look.
Is this draft that we're in now just really funky in that we're not crushing but talking about evolution of bigs? And at the top we really have three bigs. Do you just kind of
we should talk about the best guys, I guess, right?
Yeah. Well, do you just
not Mark Williams, all due respect to Mark Williams,
say this is just sort of an anomaly for a draft? There's no, and I don't think it's Jason Tatum in many drafts, but there's not of that like the rangy scorer who's the guy say, hey, we reach on him. Even Jaden Ivey, the case we make for him, he doesn't have that type of size. You have a name and you're going to say it. And I'm going to yell. And you're going to say, take Shaden Sharpe first. And I'll disagree with it.
Oh, no, I'm not.
Oh, so who's the name?
Are we sure that Jabari Smith like isn't that?
If he can,
like, I mean, like, look, like
you're going to yell back, but like, if you do more off the dribble other than like a one dribble pull up and the arm thing and the jumpers, could he get there? Yeah. Perfect world. Like that's the ceiling. But until he has the,
Jason Tatum's
so special when he catches the ball that it's not like a face up and it's going to be a jumper. It's like the sidestep jumper into a crossover to another one. You leaned in, he leaned in. Jabari doesn't have that bag yet. So if he can get
Jabari there, will be different than that. Totally. But I just mean in terms of like, The whole skill of Jason Tatum is Jason can just get to his spot whenever the fuck he wants, rise up and shoot up over the top, right? Because that's who he is. And like he can drive and he's gotten better at drawing fouls. And I think that that's the part of his game that is a little bit different from Jabari. But like Jabari's fucking 18 years old and he gets to his spots and shoots over the top pretty easily already.
Yeah, he does. You're trying to sell me off Chet. It's not going to happen. I like the sell
of it. But like that, this is what I'm saying though. Like, this is the positional value of like a Jabari Smith in terms of like, I'm like, look, I don't think he's going to be Jason Tatum. I don't think he's going to be like a first team all NBA guy.
Don't pull that.
But like, if you told me that he ends up being like a Chris Middleton that can like really just get to his spots and pull up and knock down shots at a, you know, 50, 40, 90 clip at some point, that's a real outcome for Jabari Smith, I think. Like, bigger Chris Middleton, who's good defensively, and, you know, you can rely on him to be really strong on the ball, and you can rely on him to be a good weak side rim protector. Like, I don't know. I think that guy's really good.
I think he's really good, too. I have him second. And I know the Auburn guards have gotten a lot of flack for how they kind of set him up for shots and not necessarily for success, like end of the shot clock, like here, do it, shoot it. But he's kind of
create also, everything.
He did. But if you're talking Jason Tatum, Middleton's a little different. Like he's a creator. So you have to excel in that role as a creator. If Jabari Smith goes Let's say he goes second, right? He goes to Oklahoma City. Josh Giddey's going to find you, right? You go to the Magic, right. It might just be a little bit different. They'll get up and down. They need shooting. They do. But that's not just necessarily...
Don't you remember the Jason Tatum draft conversation?
Yeah, where people... I was very wrong. I thought that he was just like a one-way player. I was all in on Markelle Fultz. I said that many, many times. I mean, the conversation I was completely wrong on.
People at Jason Tatum, look, I had Tatum at two. I loved him. But, it's like the one thing I feel like I've gotten very right over the years, and I didn't even get it totally right. You know what I mean? But Jason Tatum, people had him sixth and seventh on their boards coming into that draft. Cause they were he's just selfish. He doesn't really pass the ball well.
He eats tacos, mid-range ketchup on him. We can't trust a guy like that.
He's just a mid-range gunner, but yes. I know. But this was a real conversation with Jason Tatum coming into the draft. And I feel like the more I watch Jabari, the more I'm this feels like a similar conversation where the guards were not very good at getting him the ball in good spots. Mm-hmm. Jabari doesn't turn... I think he just turned 19. He won't turn 20 until the end of his first NBA season. So it'll be Jason Tatum is still 19 years old. Thing. Jason
He'll
Tatum
still be the same age at that point. He'll turn 19. Yeah. Tatum's eternally 19.
But Jason Tatum, was so young coming into that first year at Duke, and Jason Tatum, and I think we're undervaluing that Jabari Smith is a year younger than Chet. And
he is. Yeah.
I think 6 months younger than Paolo. He is earlier in his basketball development than these guys to a pretty substantial extent. I'm not saying he's the next Jason Tatum. I want to be very clear about this. I just,
that's not the clip that's going to go on YouTube.
Believe me. I think that there are some real, in terms of the way the playoffs operate right now, being able to rise up and get to your shot efficiently when the game breaks down, and when it's grimy and muddy, like we saw in that game five, that is an incredibly valuable skill. And I think that Jabari Smith is going to be able to do that at the NBA level at the end of the day.
Yeah, I'm pulling up the Duke roster from that team that Tatum was on. It's a good parallel in a sense that Frank Jackson was your point guard, right? Grayson Allen, Luke Kennard. So not always the most ball movement either. You look at sort of the assist numbers and they don't pop out at you. It's 3.5 assists, 2.5 assists. So there wasn't the most ball movement either. So maybe that's sort of the precursor from Jabari Smith, that he was a kind of a product of his environment, playing with Wendell Green and playing with KD Johnson, that he wasn't necessarily had the platform to show it all. I thought he showed enough. We've read all the rumblings, the sources, the rumors that he's there for number one. It's a case. Regardless, it's a case.
Yeah. So I guess as we're talking about bigs and fitting bigs into a playoff box, right? I don't think of him as a big, really. I think of him more as a four and more of a player that can switch defensively and is going to be able to stick in the playoffs very easily. Chet and Paolo, on the other hand, I think Chet is going to be able to take advantage skill-wise of other teams offensively. He's going to be able to space the floor. He can put the ball on the floor. I don't think Chet's going to have any problem staying on the court defensively in a playoff series. I don't think Paolo is going to have too many problems with it. I worry about his defensive instincts, but Paolo, again, is so skilled, so gifted offensively that if you play him at the five, he's definitely going to be able to take advantage of fives. Can you play Paolo at the five? I worry a little bit about, but I think you probably can, don't you think?
You can.
In the playoffs, at least.
Yeah. Again, it depends on your personnel and your length, 1-4, but you could. Yeah. I wouldn't be worried about that one. He's not a traditional big per se in that he's this bigger wing-ish type creator offensively, where he's not a back to the basket post. These are all new age, new school ways of looking at fours and fives anyway.
Yeah. I mean, so you brought up this idea of the bigs at the top. I think you're probably going to be fine with bigs at the top in the playoffs, which is why they're still at the top of the draft. Whereas someone like Jalen Duren, who started at the top of the draft this year. And as we saw more and more of him, we kind of slid him down the board because we worry about whether or not he can stay on the court in the playoffs. Like, do you think that that stands to reason?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That's why we talked about it here on this podcast. I've flip-flopped Mark Williams and Jalen Duren throughout this process because of that. Because I do imagine and envision, and you asked earlier, does watching the playoff change that? Yeah, you still need a big who can do more than one thing that can, even if you're dropping, can still recover a little bit or show and get back. And I worry about him doing that just with the hard hedges, with his feet and going drop. And then if the offense scoring isn't really there, then what's he giving you when they're trying to hunt him in pick and roll situations like a lot of bigs are during the playoffs?
Yeah, the whole Jalen Duren conversation is interesting because I'm just lower on the movement skills than what I think other people seem to be. Like I've talked to very smart people and even like very smart people who do this on the internet. And like, it's weird. Like I just fundamentally disagree with some of them in terms of like, I think his feet are so much heavier than someone like Bam Adebayo I think his feet are even much heavier than like DeAndre Ayton's defensively. Yeah. And it's going to be harder for him out on an island against really good guards to be able to deal with that. But you talk to other people and they feel differently. Like I think that that's a reasonable evaluation. I just don't necessarily agree with it.
That's the value play though. That's like the, I love Robert Williams at 27, not at 5. I love Jalen Duren at 20 and not 6. If he's 20, or I don't have the actual picks lined up right here, or sort of that area. And I don't think
20, I think, is San Antonio, too, who could use someone like that.
Great. Yeah.
San Antonio, here, this is a perfect one, right? For San Antonio, San Antonio has pick 9 and pick 20. Mm-hmm. You love Jalen Duren at pick 20. Do you love Jalen Duren at pick 9?
I don't think I have to. Right? I mean, don't you have other bigs on the board that you can love more at 9? Or do you just do that like replaceability of what the value is on those picks for you?
Well, like, would you rather take Dyson Daniels and Jeremy Sochan and then take Walker Kessler at 20? Or would you rather take Jalen Duren at number 9 mm-hmm. and take Jalen Williams at number 20 or something like that?
That's not fair. Can I do a hybrid? Can I take? Well, can I just sign a big free? No, it's a good one. Yeah, you're mine. Because I love Jalen Williams, and I think box A is what I would do. Like, I don't think
I would.
We're saying this. You don't have to reach for bigs, but if he's there at 20, that's awesome. And it's sort of like with Scottie Barnes. Like, I love Scottie Barnes, not as much as a lot of people. I'm not trying to do revisionist history here. But the more he slid with picks, I'm like, great, he's going to get to a place where he can develop. He's not called on to be the number one option. He'll be fine. He gets with an unbelievable franchise in Toronto that developed him. I just believe that if you get into the 20s with some of these bigs, there's not as much pressure immediately to be the guy and score every possession on offense and stop every play on defense. You get down and become a rotational player, that seventh, eighth man, on a contender or somebody who's trying to win games, then you can have these Robert Williams type impacts.
Yeah, no, I think I would rather do that. And like, by the way, like I don't even think Walker Kessler is going to be able to play in the playoffs. Like I don't see that for him at all. But I would still rather take the flyer on Sochan or Dyson Daniels than take Kessler and then have a great rim protecting big in the regular season and then figure out my situation in the playoffs. Then take Duren, who I think can, you know, potentially play in the playoffs, but wouldn't be able to yet. And then take like more of a flyer on Jalen Williams, who might not get to 20. Like I tried to make it specifically hard, because like that was the purpose, but, you know, the diminishing returns on that get there quickly, where if it's Malachi Branham instead of Jalen Williams, it's
killing me.
Yeah, you do like Malachi. It's, you know, Ochai or Dalen Terry or someone like that instead of Williams, right? Yeah,
these are still all penny guys. Guys I really like.
And guys I really like too, but like nonetheless. Like
Jalen Williams, you know, is a really good one though. Like Jalen Williams, we had a prospect of the week in like January or February, right?
Yeah.
Like whatever. Not doing the pat on the back ahead of the curve thing. But I was like, great guy in the 40s. And now he's playing well. It's like, all right, great guy in the 30s because of the combine. Is he a lottery pick? So it's different, though, when you say Jalen Williams lottery pick versus Jalen Williams 25th. 25th, we're celebrating. We're going to the bar. We're doing backflips. 13th, it's like, do we get like too far ahead of ourselves buying into this thing? And you're going to take your guy, regardless of who it is. Just the value for me more is like getting them a little bit later than reaching early.
Right. Right. And let's finish this conversation before we get to the post-combine narratives of Jalen Williams here. Mm. I feel like we just like kind of talked for 25 minutes and didn't really come to any solutions here. I think that like the hypothetical of what San Antonio has here is kind of an interesting way to think about it, like in terms of what the specific gives and takes are of drafting a big versus drafting a wing and then going vice versa later in the draft. The diminishing returns are real, like on the wing side, whereas on the big side, Jalen Duren's definitely better than Walker Kessler, but yeah. Like how much better?
That much better, right? Yeah. So you take best player available. You're in the lottery for a reason. Get better and then fit for need as you go on.
Well, is it specifically though that you take best wing available?
Yeah, that's sort of our conversation full circle, right? It's how awesome is Jason Tatum? How awesome is Giannis? How awesome is these guys that can defend and score and be a wing and switch and not be just, hey, if the jumper's not falling, like, we don't know what to do with them. Like, if you can't switch, we don't know what to do with them. How do you get, like, a little bit of each of that and put together one prospect? And generally that equation ends with taking a bigger wing if they're there.
Well, and this is kind of the last question to end on. The things that we've found are valuable are shooting and being able to switch and being able to play defense in space and being able to do all of these things, right, that fit in the playoffs. Having dribble pass shoot skills, right? If you're picking an imperfect prospect, like a Jeremy Sohan, like a Dyson Daniels, or like an AJ Griffin, who is all shooting, no defense right now, which one do you think is more valuable and which one do you think you can better or more easily morph into a player that can be valuable in the playoffs?
Wow. I would take of that group the first two. I would take Sohan and not need him to necessarily be my offensive firepower. Like, I don't need that guy. Just come in and play D and switch 1 through 5. Like, we'll tell you what to do on offense. Don't worry about it, but just switch. If you're worried about AJ Griffin's feet and who he's able to cover out there, I don't want him to be hunted. You can't hunt Jeremy Sohan. You can't. Like, you can't really hunt Dyson Daniels. I want to be the hunter, not the hunted. Like, I want to be the one pressing. Like, great. If you hit it to the wing and you say Sohan can't shoot, you give him a ton of space, who cares? We'll do a dribble handoff. We'll space back out. I can reverse the ball. You can't really reverse on defense. Like, you can switch, but that millisecond that you do, something happened where the floor gets slanted for the other team. You don't want that in the playoffs.
I think I agree with you. I think it's part of the reason that Miami has been so successful is that they've been willing to dive into these imperfect players and make them work. Finding, all offense, Tyler Hero and making him work, Duncan Robinson. And they've gotten pretty far doing that. And now they're, in the conference finals and Max Strus is playing, up until the last couple games, at least over Duncan Robinson, because he's a two-way guy. And I think that you can figure out a way to kind of make that work. But I think that it's easier to teach shooting than it is to teach the tools that are necessary to defend on an NBA court. Like Duncan Robinson, I love the guy and I have an immense amount of respect for what he's built, and the money that he's going to make in his NBA career is phenomenal. I don't think you can teach that guy to defend. Like, I don't think he has the frame for it. I don't think he has the quickness for it. You can, hopefully kind of teach PJ Tucker to shoot though, right? To take two guys on the Heat. So that's kind of where I'm at on it. Okay. Post-combine narratives. You mentioned Jalen Williams. Feels like a good place to start. Yeah. Jalen Williams. How high is too high for Jalen Williams? Because it feels like that is now a thing.
Lottery, right? Is that probably the highest that I'd say? Like, where I have him right now is on my very vaulted big board here is I have him 18th. And even that feels like high, but you take the shot at him there based on everyone else that's available as we kind of like low-key crush the top of the draft. But when you start creeping into like 10, 9, could he go 7? That just seems too much. So he had a really good year. I love the offensive versatility. He's like a bigger, stronger wing with long arms, but can shoot, has a handle, really good vision. I don't know if that's really a lottery pick. Could be, and that's what you're betting on. But also, like, I like the late riser, but like, how much of the incline is too steep for us to fancy here?
That's what I'm trying to figure out right now with Jalen. Like, yeah, I don't know. I don't have an answer to you. I would take him in the top 20.
You asked the question. But, that's too high. I don't know.
Yeah, I would take him in the top 20, but I need to do the draft guide profile thing and like watch a shit ton of his games and like really confirm it. Like I feel good about taking him in the top 20 right now because I've seen enough, but like to know where is too high, like do you take him or AJ Griffin? Like you probably still take AJ, I think.
You probably do, and it's why like we make these big boards and then say who do you take and say like the other person, because I don't want it. Like I'd say Jalen Williams, but I have AJ Griffin higher. So yeah. It will be like team and need dependent, and it will rely on intel and medical and interviews and not just stuff on the court too for both players.
Look, like AJ's really, you know, like missed multiple seasons of his career with injury, so like the medical won't be important to him though is, you know, it will be like it, not to say that he has a concerning medical. I don't know. Do not aggregate this. This is not this is not me saying that the medical is concerning. This is me saying, look, NBA teams, I can say this, NBA teams do want to see AJ Griffin's medical and confirm that it's good. I didn't talk to you about the combine though on the podcast, and I do want to give you the floor to just, you know, give some thoughts.
I have a couple takes I took, and I thought you and Spins were great covering it. A couple side notes as I was reading the book, watching the pod with you guys. Can we make it mandatory to at least measure? Like, don't have to do medical. That's fine. You don't want to play. You want to be a semi-Mr. Man. That's fine. Can we get everyone measured? Can we just do height, weight, wingspan, hand size, maybe get crazy and do vertical? I just don't like it when – and we made fun of it on a podcast. Great. They invited 76 guys and – the G League elite camps of the 40, whatever, 45 guys don't play. We'll talk about that next. But can we at least get measurements of what these guys actually are? Like, that's the part that kind of like drives me crazy.
Yeah. When I wrote the thing that I wrote with Hollinger, John wrote the idea of like, okay, if you want to join the players, so like put a carve out in the collective bargaining agreement, basically saying like, if you want to join the Players Association, you have to come in and do, you know, X, Y, and Z at the combine, literally just like measure and take a medical. Like, that's it. Like, that's all you have to do.
Yeah.
I talked to a couple of agents about it, and they were honestly like, yeah, like if people wanted to do that, okay. And you would think they'd be the people that would say no. And then I talked to a couple of NBA team personnel about it, just like literally pitching them the idea of like, what would be the downside of this? Basically, like one person said, like the agents have a lot of juice with the Players Association and they like to control where their players go. And the Players Association is going to listen to them on it and say not to do it. So like, it feels like to me, there is some leeway here to like maybe make this a thing in the next CBA. Given that like I've talked to agents about it and like some agents are like, go for it. But like the whole thing on why this happens is that agencies like to wield it as like a powerful tool in order to maybe try and steer a prospect to, you know, X, Y, and Z team. You can't really do that once you get outside of the top 10. It gets a little bit harder. But like, you know, like freaking Jeremy Sohan like didn't measure. And
a lot of people. You know, what was it long?
I have Jeremy very high, but like Jeremy's not a guaranteed, you know, top 8 pick, right?
No, and I just thought that maybe because – was it last year or the season before when the NBA is like, no, we're actually measuring you. We're actually getting your weight. Like, you're not going to make up that you're 6'10 when you're 7 feet tall and you say you're –
what, are they going to kidnap Chet Holmgren and make him, like, go into the – like
you're getting weighed right now. It's, yeah. It's the scene in Old School. They pull up the van and like, you say they're going to kill you. Like, that's what we're going to do to like get guys to get weighed. Whatever it takes, man. It's dumb. At some point, you're going to get weighed. You're going to get measured. Like, why we go to combine and like, I'm just going to do like a couple of crummy interviews, like not give you real answers. And yeah, I'm not going to weighed. I'm not going to play. I'll answer some things where they cut away from the TV. And I'm like, can you go back to the combine? Like, I want to watch 5-on-5. Like, these interviews are awesome. Get a lot of stuff out of it. Yeah. But like, it just seems like a weird thing.
Yeah. Let's make this a real campaign from the podcast. Like, please, in the next collective bargaining agreement, make it so that to join the NBA and to join the Players Association, whatever the fuck it is, you have to submit at the combine to a medical and to measurements. Like,
yeah, don't have medical, to do team medical, interviews, medical don't will have be to tough, media. Right? But it should. I think that's another hurdle. I think the first hurdle is height and weight, right? I think medical will be like even more. Is this like the halfway thing?
But the medical is the thing that NBA teams want, though. Like, totally. They care about the measurements. They don't really care about the measurements. They want the medical. Like, they want to confirm that these guys are healthy at the end of the day.
Which is right? it's just a crazy ask. Like, hey, we're going to pay $50 million. Can we just see, like, if he's good or not? Like, nope, just got to, like, buy it off the lot. No test drive, just got to take it. Is there anything under the hood we have to worry about? Just drive it, see what happens. It's weird, man. It's really weird.
Yeah, I don't think that it's asking a lot. I really, like, I think that that is, like, a genuine carve out. And I think that, like, the couple of NBA people I talk to, like, they're 100% right in terms of what, like, the reasoning behind why we don't have it is. I'm sure that, you know, the players have fought against it. And I'm sure that, like, part of it is too, the players, like, probably don't love the idea of having their long-term medical records, like, in a record somewhere for NBA teams to be able to pull up whenever free agency happens. Because while draft prospects are not yet a part of the Players Association until they're drafted, they are eventually going to hit free agency, and then teams are going to be able to look back through their medical records and go, okay, you know, this guy has a, you know, 20% chance of having a long-term knee injury, or like, right. You know, they're going to have their doctors look through it and then decide, okay, we're going to cut his salary in free agency by 20%. And every team will have access to it. So it'll essentially be like a collusive environment, right? I'm sure that that's the reasoning behind it, but if I was NBA teams, I would fight for that, I guess.
Doesn't our iPhones have all that anyway? Don't people already know? There's smarter people than us that packed into like our health app and see how tall and how much we weigh and what happened to my AirPods. It just you should do it. I think it's just a silly thing.
Okay. Next Matt Penny point on the combine.
This is my last combine point, and I know it's been beaten to death. And I want to revisit this after the draft in a month. After it happens, the picks are kind of selected, and here we are. Playing matters. I don't like the non-top 20 guaranteed guys or so deciding not to play. It hurt the handful of guys last year, Sharif Cooper and Jalen Johnson. Warranted or not, yeah. Like their stock dropped. I would have liked to have seen Wendell Moore, Dalen Terry, Max Christie, JD Davidson just play, because maybe the context in college was wrong for those guys. And lots of them in interviews, when you get feedback talking to teams, they politely say some of those things, right? Not throwing anybody under the bus, but you're part of a greater team concept. They accepted their role. It was a little bit different than what they envisioned as a pro. Now you have the chance to go out there and play and be more of an individual in the combine, and you shut it down. So scouts, they just get a lot more out of 5-on-5 than a pro day workout where everyone looks good. It drives me crazy, because if you go to see an NBA player workout, or you go to an NBA arena pregame, those guys don't miss. It's not very often that they're like missing two or three jumpers in a row. So despite the editing and everything we see, it's great to see shot mechanics and movement and if they're in shape or not, that's awesome. But I want to see these guys play. I want to see them actually play 5-on-5. It's another just risky proposition. If you're outside that kind of top 20 guaranteed range, you can tumble, man. If it happens for two classes in a row, I hope the next group of guys will say, I don't want to be like that where I dropped 20 spots because I wasn't playing.
Okay, so here are your group of players that did not do athletic testing last year at the combine. BJ Boston dropped, right? James Bouknight slid on draft night, not necessarily due to not doing combine things, but slid on draft night from where people thought he was going
to
go.
But I would advise him not to play because he was like a top 20-ish guy. I would not have rolled him out there.
Jared Butler had his own
things. He had his own medical stuff, yep.
Yeah. Sharif Cooper, slid. Cade Cunningham, Jalen Green, locked in top five picks. Mm-hmm. No chance they should play. Isaiah Jackson probably went where he was supposed to, right? Like, that's a normal one.
But where Jalen did he go? Johnson, like, he went like 21 or so, right? Like, that's sort of like, that's the line for that. Isaiah Jackson, up or down?
Jalen Johnson and Kai Jones. Jalen Johnson went 20th. Kai Jones went 18th. Honestly, they slid from where they were supposed to go when the pre-draft process started. Jonathan Kuminga locked in top seven pick or, you know, wherever he went. I think he went seventh. Isaiah Livers, I think, was coming off of the foot injury, last year.
He didn't play in the tournament, right? He had the t-shirt on, paying players. Yep. Yeah, he wasn't playing.
Trey Mann didn't slide. Trey Mann didn't decide to do anything, didn't slide. Davion Mitchell did not slide. Evan Mobley locked in top five pick. Moses Moody slid to 14. Not someone that did anything, and I feel like that didn't hurt him.
He didn't test. He didn't test either. I wouldn't anticipate to play 5-on-5, but like Mark Williams tested. Like, hey, 9'9" standing reach. Great, you did your part. Yeah,
I'm sure that he measured, but I'm talking about did athletic testing as well.
Got it.
De'Ron Sharpe, Cam Thomas, both of whom, you know, slid to the end of the first round.
Yeah.
Right. And there, for some reason, something is popping in my brain that De'Ron Sharpe might have had a reason for not doing it. I can't remember off the top of my head, but like more guys there slid than stayed steady. Mm-hmm. Right. Just do it. Like, and then teams, for whatever reason, whether you're good at basketball or not, teams care about this stuff and they think you're not competitive if you don't do this. Just fucking go test at the very least.
Well, they're going to find out eventually. And that's what it's like. You did the assignment or you didn't. Like, at some point you're playing and you don't want to hurt your draft stock. I understand that. That's the other flip of the coin. If you feel comfortable in your range and you can live with falling 10 spots, and maybe there weren't as many guys who were the Bones Highland or were the Josh Primo or probably the Jalen Williams this year, and I'd even throw Tre'Quavion Smith into that bucket too. But for the really fringy first round, second round guys, I'd say you got to play.
Yeah, and like at the end of the day, like I don't even know that I'm advocating playing in the 5-on-5. I think it'd be smarter for some of these guys to play in the 5-on-5 unless they have promises. But like at least go through the process of doing the combine stuff. Like it just makes more sense, I think. Okay. I'm excited to get like six agents calling me after that little section there and being like, fuck off.
What did you do? It's fine. We'll go to your pro day. Don't worry about it. We'll be there.
Fucking pro day. I can't with pro days. Like,
they're good. It's okay.
Spin said on the last podcast, they are not real basketball. Like, it is not real life. Okay. Let's go into the mailbag. We have a lot of really, really good.
What was our number roughly this week?
All right, let's see here. I've got like 70 plus.
That's a lot. Here.
Yeah. Thank
draft
you.
Draft season. We thank you.
Are so appreciative of it. We can't get to all 70, but you know, what can you do? Okay. Let's see here. Penny's from Jared Katz, Jared Katz 30. Penny's favorite type of pizza from Antonio's.
Oh, wow. What a question. So it was chicken bacon ranch for sure. So chicken bacon ranch or chicken quesadilla. Mexicano is really good too. But if I had to do one, I'm not a huge bacon guy. It's chicken bacon ranch. I love that. Thank you for asking. I can taste Antonio's right now. The nostalgia. Uptown
Amherst.
Are
you now forever. Getting Antonio's tonight for dinner?
I'm not driving to Amherst. Unfortunately, I wish I were, but I'm not.
Okay.
Take me back. Give me the time machine. I'll be there in 10 minutes.
From OKC Thunder Baby. How much smoke should we be believing this long before the draft? Who are the people we should trust? I'm not going to answer the second question there.
Trust no one. We'll talk about that's the answer. Trust no one. Like, believe it a little bit, but trust no one.
I think there are things that can be trusted, but like, I also think that, you know, there's a lot of smoke happening right now. And the team that does it most, the team that is very good at it, is Oklahoma City. They are very good elite at the top of the draft. Because if you remember, last year, people had them taking everyone but Josh Giddey. And the funny thing was that I had even known that they had done more work into Josh Giddey than all but like two teams in the NBA. And they probably did more than what I know into Giddey.
They had that sneaky workout, that they would take, right? Didn't have a sneaky work on L.A. That was like kind of like hush hush. They worked him out. It's like whatever. They're taking James Book night. Like everyone knows
I think they had about? Like scouts like get through like 2 weeks of quarantine to like see him in Australia. Like I don't think it was just like Toronto that did that. Like,
I love that. It's beautiful.
Yeah. But yeah, no. Oklahoma City is very good at this. And
it's,
look,
it's hard even for people that connected to like waft through what it is too.
Yeah, I think that we're starting to see a lot of smoke from teams. Like, I think that Orlando's starting to throw it. I think Oklahoma City's starting to throw it. It's hard to know what to believe. Even as someone who has real connections throughout the NBA, it's hard to know what to believe and like where to figure out the values from. Let's see. When it comes to team building, this is from Parker Eves Price. When it comes to team building, do you prefer to have multiple ball handlers who can create or one great creator with good 3-point shooters?
That depends on like who the player is. I wouldn't necessarily say it's one or the other. I guess multiple, unless you're telling me like my main guy is a top 10 player in the league and he has shooters around him. But as soon as that guy gets dinged up or hurt, as we've seen, then you're looking around at each other like, okay, who's going to score? I can shoot threes. Great. Can you create? No, not really.
Yeah, I think that, you know, if you have a great defender that can stay honest on that one great creator, it allows your help defenders to not have to collapse, and you can just stay honest on the 3-point shooters and try and contest or just let that one guy beat you from 2-point range. I think that I prefer multiple ball handlers personally. I think that's how you win in the playoffs. Like, you need to have a couple of guys. I think even Dallas has multiple great ball handlers in Luka and Jalen Brunson. And, you know, I don't think they get this far. They certainly haven't gotten that far in the playoffs the last 2 years before Jalen took this leap. Right. So, yeah, I think multiple great ball handlers, if that's the question. From Andrew Eastwick, this is one that I kind of wanted to get into. Is there a case for Mark Williams over Jalen Duren?
Oh, did I say Mark Williams number one? There's definitely a case. I think I'm there. I have Mark Williams 12th and Jalen Duren 14th. So I do have that.
Yeah, I keep going back and forth on it. I do think I have Mark slightly higher. The reason that I have Mark higher is because I think he is much better positionally. I think he's much better in terms of just having different types of like variable pick and roll coverage. And part of this could just be Memphis decided to drop the whole year, and they didn't really. Like, they did some other things, and I thought that Jalen got very heavy-footed and handsy out on the perimeter. And Mark can get a little bit handsy, but it's not quite as bad. I think his positioning's better. I think his feet are just as good as Jalen's. And I think that he just has better tools. Like, Mark Williams has elite physical tools. He has a 9'9" standing reach that is bigger than all but one person in the NBA. And that one person might be out of the NBA next year. So, like, it's hard for me to look at Mark Williams and Jalen Duren and say, oh, Jalen Duren is the upside play, when Mark just, like, kind of has better tools than what Jalen Duren does. Not like I have them very close. I don't think there's like an enormous difference between them as prospects, because I think that where Jalen actually does succeed over Mark is he has more offensive skill and there's a little bit more offensive firepower there with what Jalen might be able to like short roll eventually and pass, and he might be able to put the ball on the deck once, you know, to finish. I don't think Mark's going to really be able to do any of that. I think Mark's going to be very limited offensively, but he might be so big and so long and so athletic that limited offensive skill set, he might just be great at it and make it work. I keep going back and forth, but I do think there is a genuine case.
Yeah. And Mark too, it's if you're just the rim runner, lob finisher, but also rim protector, and your wings and guards can just do their thing and then be in the dunker spot ready to go when the defense collapses and throw at the rim. Great. Take that guy.
Okay. This is a fun one that you're going to be able to answer a little bit more than me. I can say, you know, what I think of it, but from Michael Roth at Mike Roth OU, after 24/7 has unleashed their new 2023 prospect rankings, which I assume is for high school.
Yeah.
How much stock do you put in them? Seems like there's always prospects who the media likes more than NBA guys, even before they enter college. Who are some guys in the 2022 and 2023 draft whose high school rank didn't equal NBA draft interest?
So rankings are incredibly hard. It's very hard during our big board, yeah. and ours changed throughout the year. It's harder in high school because
it's so much harder which guys peak early,
which guys peak late, which guys have been like given too much, which guys are playing out of position, what's their actual work ethic. And it sort of like starts to make its way a little bit as seniors in high school. And then you throw it out again. They get to college and Malachi Branham's a top 30 kid. Now we're talking top 10 in the draft. Jaden Ivey was 50th in the country. Could he go number one? So it's very hard, and I think the traits are different because a lot of NBA guys, when they go to events, they look for maybe more long-term things, where if you're an evaluator in the high school space, you can't turn your eye, like blind eye, to like production either. So it's this weird kind of blend and balance, and that's why I always love it when NBA guys see high school guys for the first time, because a lot of us, and we get the same way in the draft space, it's not like consensus, but it's like sort of group thinky where we all have the same top 25 or so guys. And you sit next to an yeah. NBA scout, and they say, oh, kid can't play. He stinks. Like watch his feet here on how he tries to hedge and recover. That's never going to work. He's going to get burnt. Or, yeah, the way he shoots works now, but it's a really low release. So as you go back to NBA line, that's a block shot. It's a shot
trajectory.
Yeah. So in growth spurts and development and weight, so it's really hard to figure out what like the mix is there.
It's Eric Bossy calling Matt Penny. Yeah, to
it is. He's right here. Him. It's my dad trying to FaceTime for my son. Nobody wants to see me. So that's my roundabout way of saying that if we just rank the top 10 guys from there and pluck them into the draft, it's going to change. And those guys do an awesome job. It's a million different factors, and it's a very totally. Very inexact science.
Well, and they're evaluating for drastically different games. Like they're evaluating for both college and NBA settings, right? And those two things are so different in terms of the way they operate. Like, where is the middle ground between two things that are so different? I don't know. I will say one guy that I like a little bit more than what for the NBA than what rankings boards do. I like Terrence Arsenault.
He's a name that could pop that a lot of people said that too.
Yeah, I feel like he's what, like 35th, maybe something like that. Yeah, I don't know what range. He is in the updated mm-hmm. rankings necessarily, but yeah, I think that's just a game like 6'7", seems to have super long arms, really shoots it. Like you can easily imagine that translating to the NBA at a very high level. Do you have any strong opinions on that you think like fits the NBA a little bit better?
No, not necessarily. Just it's a hard tumble from the top. And as you go back and we can reflect and have the benefit of doing that it never ends up like exactly that way. I thought Cliff Alexander would work out of high school. I did. I'm like big, yeah. powerful. He's just going to dunk it, rip the rim off. How's that guy not play? Like he didn't stick around. Jahlil Okafor was even dominant at Duke. And then against the NBA, he's not quite the same player. So it's very different games. And as we've talked, evolution and bigs trying to shoot more and sometimes trying to shoot too much more and like be a big, just be a five that shoots instead of trying to be a three. So that's sort of my take. But I'll get to see more. I'm going back out to Pangos All-American Camp next week and see a new cluster of guys that I haven't put eyes on yet.
What a great event. Honestly, just like one of the best events of the year, I think. Yeah. Okay. From Bomb Boards, Maxwell Bombback. Oh, which player do you think has a higher ceiling than they are given credit for? And which player do you think has a scarier floor than is currently discussed? I can answer the first one while you're thinking about this. I think that people are underrating Jabari Smith's ceiling, as we kind of talked about earlier. I think that people are thinking of him as like the safe prospect at the top, right? Doesn't really have a lot of handle, doesn't pass it well, doesn't shoot. I think we're underrating the fact that he's 18 years old and can already like get to his spot for his jump shot basically whenever he wants already. And the ceiling there is remarkably high. If he continues to improve his handle, like the functional improvement of his handle is not a lot. It's just a little, and he becomes very, very difficult to guard, I think.
It's a good one. I'm going with Keegan Murray from Iowa. It's been this weird thing with Keegan where We're like, yeah, he's fifth. Okay, good. Who's sixth? Like, that's more exciting. He's really good, and he has good size. He's continued to improve. He averaged 24 points per game. He showed he's able to, like, stretch out and shoot and do some more things. We're all underselling him as just, like, the safe thing, but I'd argue it's the safest play out of, like, the first six or seven guys here. Because the other guys fall and tumble, and Chet's body can't sustain, and Jabari can't put it on the floor, and Jaden Ivey's not as good as an off-ball guy, and Paolo can't do this. Keegan Murray is going to be a really solid NBA player, at minimum, at minimum.
And then the floor, I don't know, like, I feel like Ochai Agbaji is talked about regularly as just, like, a very safe prospect. I think that, like, the worst case scenario for him is probably, like, eighth or ninth man. But that's probably lower than what people would think in terms of floor. You know, honestly, it could be lower. Like, if he's shooting, you know, if the shooting we saw at the end of the year as opposed to the beginning of the year is what it is, like, he's very much a pure rotational wing, not like a guy that you take in the top, you know, 17 or wherever he is.
Yeah, good one. And people point to the older guys and the seniors, and maybe this is it. Mine are both, I don't know. I'd say Shaedon Sharpe, just because we don't know. Like, we don't know, kind of, like,
I think people think that's a pretty scary floor, don't you?
I do. I don't want to, like, completely throw him that way either, but I just don't know enough. AJ Griffin scares me. He really does, and I don't know where to slot him on my board, because despite the shooting, if that – we just talked about the playoffs. The shooting's not there. The defense isn't there. Like, who is he as an NBA player? If he's in shape and he's healthy, excuse me, and he looks more like the kid from Archbishop Stepanak and look great in individual workouts and out of the summer circuit, fine. But with the injury history and with the shooting, it's been really good. If that's removed, who is he as a player?
From our good friend, Jeff Goodman. Who is Matt Penny most like that could be legitimately drafted this year? I'm not putting that evil on anybody.
Wait, what? Like, who's in this class who I could be? That's
pretty rough. I think Jeff's asking, like, who is your game most like?
None of the above. I'm like, I'm searching on the board here because some prospect or some agent would yell at me or you. I don't think that guy's in there. Baylor Shireman's out, so I'm out.
Yeah, no Shireman. If you grew a mullet like Luke Travers, maybe that's it.
Oh, that's a good one. My nickname in high school was Dunleavy because people said I was the worst version of Mike Dunleavy Jr. possible. And he's not in this draft. He's older than I am. So,
Earlier in the cycle, Sam, you discussed that this is from Garrett Johnson. Earlier in the cycle, you discussed that none of 2022 international prospects held a first round grade for you. Have you come around on any of them since then? Yeah, I think that Usman Jang is definitely a first round prospect for sure. Jovic, I'm a little bit more worried about than some seem to be. I do think he'll end up like at the back end of the first round for me, but like it's going to be closer because I really worry about his defensive upside comparatively to what others do.
And a little bit of the passing too, right? Just some of the passing and offensive reads. I have him 31st because he can shoot and does have decent size, but I'm not completely sold either.
How do you envision Kenneth Lofton being utilized in the NBA from draft film school? Kenneth Lofton has decided to enter the NBA draft and be fully committed to it. Penny, I will ask you.
Oh, bad ask. I don't know. I really don't know because it's an unorthodox game where it works and you don't think it is. And we spend time on defense and who does he guard and who does he cover. Where was he on your board prior to this?
Not on it.
So outside the top 100 or top 60?
Yes, top 100.
Yeah. So do you think then, with him going all the way in, I don't want to say promise, but enough positive feedback from the combine where he played well, that this was an end result that he ends up on a roster next season? Because there's still it's still summer league, right? It's still trying to work your way on. I don't say I'd be surprised, but I don't know if anyone's reaching for him in like the 40s.
I have no idea. Yeah, I love the game. Like, I love the idea of Kenneth Lofton. I am super intrigued by the fact that he came into the combine in better shape for sure. Like, he still has a long way to go. I think the pathway for him is becoming like a great shooter. He showed some like jab step 3-point shooting that was interesting at the combine. I don't know that he'll be a top 100 prospect for me, even at the end of the process. And if he is, it'll be near the bottom for sure.
Yeah. I don't think
he has any chance to defend anyone is the issue.
Yeah. Who's he guard? Fours? Probably not. Smaller for fives and a really good passer. I also don't want to like go all the way into negative town, but like a really good passer, a really good feel, but just the combination of lack of size and foot speed's a tough one in the NBA.
Okay. From Garrett Scare, with more roster spots, two-way deals, and more G League teams, will we see draft and stash picks become more obsolete? We have seen that recently, I think, actually. Like, more teams have used draft picks on American college players. I think that there is still value in drafts and stashes. Like, I was talking about this with an agent that represents an international player in this class earlier this week, and if I was a team in the 50s, I feel like I would always draft and stash in the 50s because you get an extra asset out of it. Like, unless there's a guy that is in the 50s that you absolutely adore and have like as a top 25 prospect and you just feel like, you know what, let's go for it, right? Like, we need this guy on our roster. We're going to two-way him, or we're going to give him a roster spot, like whatever it is, right? Then yeah, take that guy. But if you're in the 50s and you're just going to sign, you're going to try and sign a guy, you know, at the end of the draft to a two-way deal, why wouldn't you take, from a strategy perspective, the extra asset of being able to stash a guy, even if it's, you know, like a 5% chance, 10% chance he comes over, and then sign a guy in free agency to a two-way deal instead of just taking the guy on the two-way deal in the draft? You know what I'm saying?
I do. Just a draft.
You get the extra asset.
It's changed. The asset play changed it. My argument was going to be there's more of those. Let's draft and stash just here. Like, yes, you have a G League affiliate franchise. And in the second round, sometimes those are the conversations. Like, we'll take you right now. Will you go play in the G League? Will you take a 2A? Will you take a one-year
domestic
deal
draft
guaranteed?
And stashes, yeah.
Exactly. So that it's just shifted a little bit. And with the international class not being as strong, there's a lot of names in the second round. So I think you will see more of it in this draft class than maybe the last year or the year before.
Okay. As from Alex Young, 39. After being a creamy peanut butter snob my whole life, I now think crunchy peanut butter has an actual case for being better. Not to get too political, but where do you stand on this?
Oh, this is political. It's a non-political show. I've always been a creamy guy. I switched over in middle school, I feel like maybe for 6 months, into chunky, but I'm a peanut butter and jelly purist, and I would stay creamy. Chunky's just weird. It's just the consistency isn't always like authentic, and you don't know the bite what you're getting. Like, I want to know what I'm actually eating. I know they have just peanuts, but.
So Laura is a crunchy person, and I am a creamy person. So we always have two separate types of peanut butter in the house. I have tried, like, when we just like weren't eating as much peanut butter, I have tried to go down the road of crunchy. I probably went a year where I ate crunchy peanut butter.
Yeah.
Because I just like would have it occasionally and that was it. When I went back to smooth again, I was just like, oh, this is a no-brainer.
See,
like, this is a drastically better product, I think. So, yeah.
But you're not one of those people that is like, eh, I like creamy peanut butter, but I prefer Nutella. That seems to be like a little bit of like a weird wave too.
From Derv20. Tari Eason is an anagram for AI treason. Does this information change his draft stock at all?
Significantly. This is the smoke we're talking about. Some NBA team put that out there. They really like Tari. They want you to incorporate treason with him. That's why they have him stashed for the 19th pick.
Oh, my God. That is incredible stuff. I really like that one. There was one that I'm trying to get to. It was from someone. I'm sorry. I can't find it, but I saw it earlier when we were kind of going through. It was, who do you like better as a prospect, Josh Giddey or Dyson Daniels? Because now Josh we're starting Giddey. To get like the Dyson Daniels, like top you know, six or seven or someone, I think John said top five Buzz at one point.
Someone said five. Yeah.
Yeah. But
I think one of the,
I have gotten like, and look, I've gotten real top 10 Buzz the whole year. So that's not like new for this show. Wouldn't be crazy, I guess, if Detroit took him at five, but yeah, Josh or Dyson, which one do you like better?
Diddy. I wouldn't like Dyson Daniels with Cade. I don't think that fits what they need for him next to him, really. Like, I want another shooter, and shooting isn't necessarily what Dyson Daniels does. It got better as the year wore on. Giddy's probably a better passer, a little bit better off the dribble. Defensively, Dyson Daniels is better. You put them together, make a super Australian prospect. That's probably the answer. I don't think we have the science to do that right now. I would say Giddy. I don't think there's a huge margin there, though.
I think I would take Josh because I think that the way he processes the game, and this isn't to say Dyson is bad at this, it's just that Josh, I think, is special at this. The way that he processes the game so quickly, I think, is just so special. Dyson is a great defender, obviously, and I think that he's going to be a great – I think they're very close. I think they're very, very close in terms of prospects, and I think Dyson's going to make a day one impact. I think that if Josh ever shoots, so like the skill, the swing skill for both is shooting, right? Can both ever become high level shooters? I think Josh's ceiling is higher if he becomes a shooter, because Josh will be like a fucking all-star if Josh is a shooter.
And with Giddy, with him going to Oklahoma City and having the ball in his hands, it was obviously a building, and you're figuring out a little bit on the fly. I don't know if I'd trust Dyson Daniels kind of like my lead guard right away as much as I would Giddy, because the handle's just a little bit tighter. The vision's a little bit better. So that's why I have him ahead of him by some, not a crazy amount.
Okay. Final question. What's the highest pick? This is from Principal C.R. Porter. What's the highest pick that you would trade for Jeremy Grant in this 2022 NBA draft?
Just like straight up, not like other pieces. It's not in the top five for me. I'll tell you that.
It would depend on if I'm signing him to an extension afterward. Like, do I get the extension?
It was a weird year too for him. Like, not what I thought he would be.
I'll pitch you on this. So like, I threw this out to an agent a couple days ago. Say you're Sacramento and you're just desperately looking for that 3-4 hybrid forward and you want to try and win now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a chance that Indiana would move you Chris Duarte and number 6 for number 4? If they just like really
in Sacramento and Indiana, like, we're not doing this anymore. We've already done these weird trades.
Maybe they would. Maybe they would, right?
All right, so it's Duarte and
6 for number 4.
I'll take Duarte and 6. Well, it depends on
who's, I think, on the board. I would rather have 4 because I'd rather have Jaden Ivey.
Well, that's your answer. This is a mousetrap. I fell into it. If it's Jaden Ivey, it depends. Are you saying like you know who 1, 2, and 3 are? I'd rather have Jaden Ivey than, I guess, Duarte and who's 6? Shane Sharp, Johnny Davis, Dyson Daniels. Yeah, I prefer Ivey. So I'm.
But you prefer all of Paulo, Chet, and Jabari probably as well,
yes,
than Duarte, correct, and 6, right?
Yeah.
So if you're Indiana, you would rather have number 4 than Duarte and 6.
Yes. Yeah.
If you're the Kings, and I'm not recommending this, like I would not do this at all. I want to be very clear about this. But if you're the Kings, then you can pick up Chris Duarte, move down to number 6. Maybe you try and slide back one more time to then try and, like, you know, maybe the Spurs want to move 9 and 20 for 6, because
they
have a specific 20. Guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you pick up 9 and 20 and you're the Kings, and then you move 9 for Grant and you end up with like Duarte, Grant, and 20, as opposed to just moving number 4 for
Is this the story of like the guy that starts with a paperclip and ends up with like a four wheeler?
Kind of, like, yeah. Like that's the way I'm envisioning it.
That was for
a
roll
bit.
Of paper towels. That was for a stapler. And yeah, we got Jeremy Grant. What do you think? It's good. I lost it along the way a little bit, but I like the thinking.
it's not a bad strategy, right? Because like, are the Pistons really going to do better than like the ninth overall pick for Jeremy Grant? Like, I don't think
probably not.
So, on a 1 year deal. Like,
no,
I think that's tough, you know, unless like maybe the Blazers like are willing to do seven and sign him to an extension.
Maybe that's it. If Dame's like, hey, we need a guy, like we can't do you thing. Like we have Anfernee Simons, like we got to rock now.
And again, I would not do that. Like I wouldn't move seven for Jeremy Grant personally, but I can see that world happening. Maybe if you're the Kings, it's literally just the first part of what I said. It's like four for six and Duarte, and then you end up with Duarte and Jeremy Grant instead of just Jeremy Grant or something like that, right? Like me totally spitballing. Like I'm not reporting any of this. I'm just like trying to come up with feasible ideas that like, if you're Indiana and you love the top four prospects and you're just like kind of ambivalent on six or so, maybe like, you know, maybe that's a move that could get you into the top four, taking advantage of a Kings team that desperately wants to compete next year. If I was the Kings, I would just take Jaden Ivey. Like, just take the guy, in my opinion, and then figure out the rest later. I don't know if the Kings will feel that way because the Kings front office is on a one-year contract, and it feels like there's real pressure to win now. The Domantas Sabonis trade, I think, is evidence of that. So, yeah, that's where I'm at on all of this. It's I don't know. I don't know how smart any of that was.
That's good. That's a good experiment, though.
Yeah, I'm trying to come up with, you know, things that aren't quite brilliant, but aren't, you know, totally dumb. Okay. Movies, TV shows.
Yes.
Penny, what have you watched?
I finished Ozark. That was a journey. It was a drag to the finish. It was. I love Marty Bird. I love Jason Bateman. It took me a while. Did you watch it?
No, I haven't yet.
It took me a while to get there. It wasn't like glass over. It was more like conclusion, like, all right, whatever, shrug, it's done. Still Better Call Saul. I'm a few episodes behind. I texted you this. I never watched I Think You Should Leave, and I downloaded every episode for the plane.
It's so good.
I had like a 2-hour plane ride, and someone probably thought something was wrong with me. I was crying the first skit, the infomercial about the toilets. I could not control myself. And the other two, I started watching Under the Banner of Heaven on Hulu with Andrew Garfield. I'm a few episodes in on that, and I'm three episodes in on Candy with Jessica Biel on Hulu also.
So
my goal is to finish those next two episodes tonight before the playoff game tomorrow. Good. I'm into it. She's really, really good. I know where it's going because it's a murder mystery. The murder happens. No spoilers. That's the first episode. Like, somebody's dead. Yeah. I figure it out. Haven't like totally had all the things in the right place yet, but I'm hoping for a turn here. But more importantly, you tweeted about it. You're excited about it. What movie did you see in theaters this week?
Top Gun Maverick. It came out here before it came out in the U.S. for some reason.
I told somebody in the office today, they said, it's out? I was like, I don't know. Sam said he saw it.
It came out on Tuesday here as opposed to, I think it comes out tomorrow for you guys. It is one of the best movie experiences at the theaters I've had in years. Like, Laura and I had the conversation afterward. We were like, when was the last time we had a conversation or had a experience in the movies that was that good? I think that like I enjoyed it more than both the Avengers movies. I think it might be like Mission Impossible Fallout for me.
Okay.
Like, it's that good. It is so amazing.
Is it so amazing? Like, we're talking corny amazing. Like, that was amazing. They just did a reboot. I know it's different and whatever, but was it like getting the 80s juices flowing again, that you're back in that world that doesn't exist? Or as a standalone, if there wasn't a Top Gun 1 per se, would you still be as excited as you are about Top Gun now?
You definitely need to see Top Gun 1 for it to be as emotionally resonant as it can be. But it's still fucking outstanding. It's so good. Like
there's even if you just have to ask,
remove that, like there are the plane sequences in this movie are fucking insane. They're crazy. And like you are like watching this and like glued to the screen. It is like, I don't know how they did it.
Well, my buddy Elliot was telling me today in the office that it's like they actually were in the planes for like 14 hours or something nuts for like 40 seconds of filming. Like they were that precise with what it was.
I don't know enough about it, but I do know that when I was watching it, I was like, I have no fucking idea how you filmed that. Like,
as long as it's not a green screen where it's like a plane flying, it's like that's superimposed. That's not real.
Yeah, no, it's nothing like that. Like there are a lot of sequences where I'm just like, I have no idea how you did that, but this is absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, what was your question?
Is there volleyball?
There is not volleyball.
I thought they'd do like an homage to that, like roll a volleyball across, like old time's sake. What do you think? No, nothing.
You'll see. There's okay. There's not volleyball. There's something else.
Okay. Pool volleyball. That's a good one. I am a big time, long time Jurassic Park, Jurassic World fan. I saw Jurassic Park the first day it came out in theaters. Yeah. My dad let me skip school. Same thing for Jurassic Park 2. That's a big one for me. You said I have to see Top Gun before that. I guess that,
you have
that
2 weeks
comes first in the – yeah, I do. World. But I also – depends on the NBA playoffs and what days stuff happens. Because right now my TV is so limited. Normally I'd finish these series, TV series. But the games just being every other night, it's like I don't have that Australian window of time where, hey, the game ends. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Now what? Which would be awesome. Well,
we need the Warriors to win. Like, that's it.
No, don't say that. Why?
Right? Why, so you can go see Top Gun on Saturday.
Yeah, I guess. Celtics to win, not the Warriors.
Well, I'm saying if the Warriors win, the series ends. But I guess Celtics win, the series ends too, right? So, yeah. Correct. Yeah. We just need...
Celtics win. Celtics win, I can go. Yeah, Saturday. Exactly. Memorial Day. What's better Memorial Day than see Top Gun in theaters?
Oh, my God. Just... Go wave your American flag. You gotta love it.
I'm such a I can't do it as much anymore with my job, but I used to be like a good like afternoon matinee guy with like nobody around, spread out, have your Diet Coke, have your popcorn.
Yeah.
It's harder for me as I get older and crankier to be in like a full movie theater. Some experiences like make it better, but a lot of times I'm like, I don't just stop talking through the movie, stop yelling. Just they're gonna fly the planes. Just let them fly. I want to enjoy this.
Yeah. Yeah, this I did not see it with a raucous crowd. Hot take: the Australian audience may not have reacted to Top Gun in quite the same way as the American audience would have.
Tom Cruise, get him! He's right there.
Yeah, like when Tom Cruise walks up in front of an American flag, and it's like very clearly like a statement of patriotism.
Yeah, you know, no, but nobody's yucking it up, cheering from the crowd.
Okay. Penny, I watched Shining Girls. I told you Shining Girls.
Yes, great. I just saw the preview the first time last night. It looked awesome, but I haven't seen it yet.
It's pretty bonkers. What I've seen so far. To the people that sent us questions that we didn't get to, thank you. I appreciate it. Might try and do like a quick YouTube mailbag to answer some other ones that we didn't get to at some point, maybe this weekend. If you want your questions answered, go subscribe to the YouTube channel, Game Theory Podcast with Sam Vecini at YouTube. What else? Penny, tell the people where they can find you. That's the most important part here.
Oh, I'm easy to find. I'm on Twitter, Matt_Penny. That's all in my work here and there. Two places, really easy. If you're listening to the pod, you're here already. So half the battle. Come back here. I'll be here eventually.
Yeah, well, I think I'll have a big board update next week whenever we finalize the actual early entry list.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of waiting on decisions before I really update. And it will be a pretty sizable update because now that I'm like getting through the draft guide and like significantly diving into the like little intricacies and details of these guys, I've moved some players around pretty substantially. Go read and look at that. I would say whenever it comes out, I will also have a playoffs thing at some point this weekend because I want to talk about playoffs and I will find someone that is willing to do so with me. But Until next time, we will talk soon. Bye.